on. Good evening, everyone. It's great to see you all out there in the Zoomiverse. I've lost track a little bit, but this must be about 6 weeks in that we've been doing this, isn't it? Something like that,
yeah.
Are you getting a little tired of it? I don't mean just the Zoom, but at first there was the kind of adrenaline and excitement of this is a crisis and we've got to deal with it. But now, you know, I think people are getting a little tired, a little impatient with it all, and so it's really important to stay steady with each other, stay patient with ourselves, yeah, and get lots of fresh air, if at all possible. Michael and I went to a beautiful waterfall this afternoon with the evening light pouring through the trees, and that really helped get those, what do you call them, negative ions that the waterfall stirs. Anyway, it's my turn to speak this evening in our ongoing series on the Tibetan Lojong teachings. We've been using this book by our teacher, Norman Frischer, Training in Compassion, Zen Teachings on the Practice of Lojong, for those of you who maybe haven't been here before. And these teachings are a series of 7 points called point mind training points, and they're divided into 59 slogans. But rather than move on to the next set of slogans, the next point, tonight I really felt compelled to look again at one that has, I think, been a kind of koan for me from before I ever even heard of it. And it's one Michael talked about last week, drive all blames into one. This teaching can so easily be conflated with the tendency that many of us have towards a kind of self-blame that's really not wholesome. So I feel like it's important to look at this one again and more deeply. And tonight I'm going to use a personal story to illustrate my point, more personal than we maybe usually are in Dharma talks, but you'll see why. And I hope you find it relevant. This slogan, drive all blames into one, is in the section that Norman calls, or the point, the fourth point called turn bad circumstances into the path. And I believe that bringing awareness to the mind of blame, the blaming mind, is a really good way to do this, to turn bad circumstances into the path. Other wordings for this slogan in other books that I've found are blame everything on one culprit. Blame everything on one culprit. That sounds kind of scary, doesn't it? And another wording, banish the one object of every blame. That's a little more cryptic. The wording that Norman uses, drive all blames into one, comes from the famous and somewhat notorious Tibetan master Chogyam Trungpa. And it's used also by Pema Chodron, his student, who has become a beloved American teacher in her own right. Drive all blames into one. The way this slogan is traditionally taught is that we need to stop blaming others. and take responsibility for our own reactions to adversity when things don't go the way we want. When our desires and our expectations are thwarted, which tends to happen on a daily basis, doesn't it, in life? One way or another, large and small. Ultimately, we can't control all these circumstances. We can't control others. But through awareness and through training the mind, we can change the way we react. And thus, how much we suffer from dissatisfaction, dukkha. The Buddha taught that self-clinging is what's to blame for our suffering. Not our neighbor, our spouse, or our political leaders. And that's what driving all blames into one means, looking at the roots of our suffering in self-clinging. The traditional view would be that adversity, you know, when bad things happen to us, it arises from our past unwholesome actions, our karma, extending from past lives into in ways that we often have no knowledge of, right? And it would be then our responsibility to purify our karma by transforming our mind, our speech, and our actions, practicing the Eightfold Path taught by the Buddha. Now, this rationale works in a culture like the Tibetan culture, which is deeply infused with the doctrine of reincarnation. But many Westerners come to Buddhist practice with an odd mixture of rational materialism and good old-fashioned Judeo-Christian guilt. So this tendency to attribute blame is very strong and very human. We need to blame somebody or something when things don't go the way we want. We feel out of control, and blaming makes us feel more in control, more powerful, more righteous. The urge to blame someone else is very strong. Blaming doesn't tolerate complexity or nuance very well, does it? Blaming likes black and white thinking, us versus them. If you're not for us, you're against us. Blaming feeds what I call the mind of enmity. But blame can also turn inwards. Those who have been blamed often, in childhood particularly, even if unjustly, can internalize blame and then habitually inflict it on themselves. And self-blame can be just as toxic as other blame. Anybody who has inflicted upon themselves has experienced that. Actually, self-blame treats the self as an other with the mind of enmity. So we have to be very careful not to conflate the slogan, drive all blames into one, with toxic self-blame, which is actually just an inverted kind of self-clinging. It's still wholly self-centered. Another pitfall of driving all blames into one is to attribute all misfortune and adversity to individual karma. If we look at the disproportionate numbers of COVID-19 deaths among the more vulnerable, because of age, poverty, homelessness, incarceration, or racial injustice, this cannot and should not be attributed to personal karma, to past life misdeeds. And Buddhist teachings have been used in that way. Perhaps most recently in the persecution of the Rohingya people in Myanmar. Okay, so now I want to tell you a personal story, kind of as a case history, on this koan of driving all blames into one. 30 years ago, my younger sister died, April 18th, in Tokyo, when the cherry blossoms were just beginning to fall. She was 35. She was a wonderful fabric artist with much yet to offer the world. When Michael and I were living in Kyoto, she came to visit us, and she stayed for a couple of months. And Michael's Japanese friend had just returned from a year in New Zealand. His mother was harassing him to go back to his engineering job, and he came to visit us as well. So he and my sister went around sightseeing in Kyoto while we went to work and worried if they were rushing into something. Over the coming year or two, she went back to Berkeley, California, where she was living. He came to visit. We moved back from Japan to Vancouver, and she moved to Tokyo, and they got married. A year after that, she suddenly became very ill with what turned out to be a rare and extremely aggressive lymphoma called Burkitt's lymphoma. The course of her illness was 7 months, and I spent 5 of those months with her. And I was there with her when she died, after the sudden failure of a last-ditch bone marrow transplant. The end came so quickly that there was no time for my family to get there. I think the most alone I've ever felt was standing in the basement of that hospital at the only payphone I could find from which I could make a long-distance international call, telling my parents that my sister would not live another day. That was before email, let alone Zoom or FaceTime. This is a much longer and more complex story than I can actually tell here, layered with individual and family and social, cultural, and international relationships, all interwoven. But what I really want to talk about now is how blaming mind played out for me in the aftermath. We had a funeral for my sister in Tokyo. It was Earth Day here that day. I came home to Vancouver a few days later, and after a week, I flew to my parents' place in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where we waited. We had to wait over a week for my sister's husband to arrive because he couldn't get a flight. And he brought her ashes. That would have been 30 years ago this week that we were waiting. And then we had a memorial service in our old hometown in the old white clapboard Baptist church, the main intersection of this very small town. I came back to Vancouver for a few weeks, and then on to Berkeley for another memorial gathering with her friends there. I felt like the ambassador of her death. By the end of the summer, I was exhausted, grieving, and angry. I was angry at my sister's husband because he wouldn't let her cry. I was angry at his family for their denial, their Japanese stoicism. I was angry at Japan and its culture of indirectness and avoidance, and for its xenophobia which left my blonde, blue-eyed sister lonelier than she'd ever been. Could I have prepared her better? But I never blamed any of them or any of that for her death, and particularly not her doctor, who did his utmost, and who wept when she died. I knew the causes and conditions were much more complex. But I was angry at my family, too, for raising us to internalize blame and not speak up for ourselves, for teaching us that if you get hurt, it's your own fault. So we learned to ignore pain. How she learned, through watching me speak up, to never ever be angry. I was angry at my society, at the land of my birth, that rogue nation south of our border here, which could not offer her health care if she returned with a catastrophic illness, so she was afraid to go back. We heard in that time that a Japanese student in Florida had knocked on a door in a suburb or a residential street asking for directions and been shot dead. So they were afraid to go back as a mixed race couple, especially with my own grandmother living with my parents. Who was not accepting, would not have welcomed a Japanese grandson-in-law. Yeah, so I was angry. I was angry. But there was nowhere for blame to land. No way to pin it down. The logic of my grief said, if you had never gone to Japan, she wouldn't have followed. She wouldn't have met him and moved there. She wouldn't have gotten sick and died. That logic, taken to its extreme, would dictate that if I had not been born first, if I had not been me, she would not have been born second, and all this wouldn't have happened. I didn't believe that I should miraculously have been able to save her, but somehow my very existence made me culpable. If you've ever experienced any kind of survivor guilt, you know what that, you've had a taste of that. This kind of thinking, as you may know, is called magical thinking. And it's characteristic of young children who are naturally self-centered, self-focused, and only gradually learn to take the perspective of others and develop the capacity for empathy. So a young child will decide that mommy and daddy are getting divorced because I was mean to my little sister. It's my fault, right? I'm to blame. Very painful. Some children in their development find that kind of pain so obliterating that they become specialists in blaming others. We don't have to look far in public life to find examples of that pattern. Others become paralyzed and constrained, always afraid of being blamed or shamed. But I digress. What happened for me was the great good fortune of already having established a meditation practice. So that September, back home at last, with everything around me looking about the same, but inside me utterly altered, I attended a week-long Vipassana retreat. I'd practiced Zen for some years already, but I had never, I think at that point, been to a full week Vipassana retreat. I was curious to learn about this other stream of the Buddhist tradition. So at that retreat, every afternoon we practiced metta, loving kindness. And I started with myself, as is traditional, And each day I expanded the practice to include first my family, and then my sister's Japanese in-law family. I spent some time with Michael and my sister's husband, Michael's friend, both of whom had a father die in just before adolescence. So somehow this all wove together. I spent time with that generation of men and women who married and started families in the years immediately following World War II. My parents, Michael's parents, my sister's husband's parents. The great silences in their lives. The great need for stability and normalcy. Covering over trauma. I wasn't so much doing this in the traditional metta practice way, based on repeating phrases, so much as I was simply sitting and attending to my heart and feeling my way into the roots of suffering. And the more I did that, the more those roots stretched deeper and wider each day, and the more entangled they became. Interwoven is maybe a better word. Intermingled. As the repentance verse goes that we chant before we recite the precepts, as this verse goes, all my ancient twisted karma, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born from body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. But it's not just my twisted karma. It's our twisted karma. You can't extricate a self of karma any more than you can extricate a self from all existence. Because ultimately all the roots meet in the common ground of our humanity. Maybe earlier yet, you know, our animal, you know, our reptile brain and our cellular being, way back. Towards the end of that retreat, I spent time practicing with the nation of my birth and with Japan, that complex love-hate relationship between America and Japan. It was much more than just doing metta practice. I feel it was a kind of deep exploration of forgiveness, of clear seeing with a heart of unequivocal kindness. And in that opening, all blame simply dissolved. I think maybe there could be another wording of that slogan. Melt all blames into one in the heart of compassion. I don't want to try and claim that in that 1 week I completely resolved my family karma. No, I did not. But there was a turning that supported further and later deepening and capacity. So here we are, 30 years later. My country of birth is in great disorder in the midst of this pandemic. And the leadership is even more deluded than it was then, on the eve of the first Gulf War. The virus has swept through my mother's nursing home in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and in the course of 1 week, it swept her away. She died Monday morning at the age of 96, and I believe she was willing to be taken. I believe she was tired of waiting. And this was her release. I've now joined the ranks of those all over the world who have been unable to be with their loved ones in their final days and hours. As we sat this past weekend here in this Zoom Zendo, she felt very close. And it came to me that this time it will be my turn not to be there. It's all too easy to feel angry at that orange-haired exemplar of delusion leading my country of birth. Not so much on my mom's behalf, but I'm thinking of Marie and Wayne, her favorite care aides, underpaid and struggling to do their jobs and take care of their families. I'm thinking of those working in those miserable meatpacking plants, of people living in New York in high-rise apartments without access to well-stocked supermarkets. I'm thinking of children going hungry in American cities. It would be so easy to feel helpless and angry as the U.S. and China engage in a tit-for-tat blame game over who let the virus loose on the world. I was reading an article called What History Tells Us About Epidemics by a health journalist named Sandra Hempel. She writes, when syphilis first struck Europe at the end of the 15th century, the French named it the Spanish disease. The English, Italians, and Germans called it the French disease. The Russians referred to it as the Polish disease, and the Poles and the Persians called it the Turkish disease. The Turks, meanwhile, took finger-pointing a stage further, dubbing it the Christian disease. As the infection continued to spread around the world, the Tahitians would blame the British, the Indians, the Portuguese, and the Japanese, the Chinese. So it seems there's no end once the blame game gets started. The only solution is to drive all blames into one, to take responsibility for our own heart, mind, speech, and actions, and to join in community with others willing to do likewise. The only solution is to melt all blames into one, into the heart of compassion where there is no self and no other. I believe this is the best way to honor the memory of those who have died and will die in this pandemic, including my beloved mom and so many others. So thank you for being out there and coming into our Zoom Zendo tonight with us. Thank you, everyone. Oh, wait, this isn't a formal Dharma talk, so we're not going to chant. How's our time? What I'd like you to do is to get into groups like we usually do, and I'd like you to just pick a blame. Please don't try and pick the biggest one. That's asking too much. Pick a smallish one. Pick a smallish one and just feel your way into melting it into one. How would you do that? How would you do that with a smallish blame? Whether your inclination is to blame is towards self-blame or other blame, either way, how would you melt it into one beyond self and other? I think we could do that. So if Michael will help me divide you into groups, because I'm not very confident about that, you'll each have about 2 or 3 minutes. We'll give you like 10-ish minutes for each group all together, and you'll have to kind of share the time, you'll have to self-time about 3 minutes each, and then we'll give you a minute or warning, and then we'll bring you back to the large group. Yeah? Okay, so Michael's going to pop you into your breakout rooms, or whatever they're called.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just check. I'll give it 29.
Not counting us. Are there anybody in twos? Yeah, Jess and River are in two.
Okay, I'll just have to...
You might have to reshuffle them.